Sanders called it security.
Oh, really?
Okay. The Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. And we have a very special guest today who's come all the way from Dartmouth College. Okay. And from the East Coast. I was thinking Cambridge. That's not even. You can tell us where it is because I'm just putting my foot in my mouth. Yeah. Little Boston. Is it? Anyway, never mind. You can explain to me my Massachusetts geography, which before I make a big fool of myself here. Anyway, so we're going to start with Dean Eldy, who's going to talk to us about the future of biofuels and the opportunities that we have in Minnesota, as well as Dr. Lee Lind from Dartmouth College and the Mascoma Corporation. Welcome.
Senator Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Robert Eldy, Dean of the College of Biological Sciences, University of Minnesota. I wear a couple of other hats, chair of the an executive committee of our initiative in renewable energy and the environment, chair of University Enterprise Laboratories, and sit on the NextGen board with several of you, sit on the OWRI Action Now Roundtable, co-chairing the research committee on that front. And I'm very, very pleased that we're gathering today to hear from our colleague, Professor Lee Lind, from Dartmouth College. This is really a very prescient time in the history of our understanding of the challenges we face as societies in terms of the impact of our activities on planet Earth. And I'm not going to go into the details of that in this presentation today, but to move our conversation towards some really interesting and truly sustainable solutions that are at hand and are of particular importance for us here in Minnesota. And so with that, I'd like to just introduce this, what is really an ad hoc enterprise on our part. We're calling ourselves the Minnesota Cellulosic Ethanol Working Group. And our goal is simple. Instead of continuing to talk about this, we'd like to see Minnesota launch the cellulosic biofuels industry. And we have an opportunity to do just that. This ad hoc collection of us are mostly university nerds who see the opportunity, but we need allies because we as university folks aren't enabled or empowered to pull this off by any stretch by ourselves. You can see the members of the committee on your handout there. And I'd also like to say that this isn't something we just thought about last night and are here today with a PowerPoint to talk about. In fact, as I'll introduce him, Professor Lee Lind is one of the longest standing and true experts in cellulosic approaches to making ethanol. Lee started this endeavor back when some of us were much younger. We were all much younger. In fact, he started this in 1978 as his honors thesis as an undergraduate at Bates College in Maine. He then came to UW-Madison for graduate studies, finished his graduate studies at Purdue. Dartmouth, excuse me, Lee.
Which is in New Hampshire.
Right. Thank you.
Remembered.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Not that far.
We're clarifying each other here.
Yeah.
And has gone on, and during the early days of the first oil crisis, so to speak, there was funding from federal sources to do this work. Lee is one of those very few individuals who has persisted over the decades in keeping this fire alive. And as a consequence, it's our judgment that the work he has done has brought to the forefront the leading technological approaches. And what is intriguing about this is that a source that not many have been thinking about turn out to be the most interesting and first step to implement this strategy. And this is the forest sector, and in particular, it's a waste stream currently from pulp mills, and we'll hear much more about it. To that end, we have here on some recent activities, that Lee has been here many times in Minnesota in the past year. Last April, he was the keynote speaker at the Institute of Technology's Technology Day dinner. We then, in July, visited plants, pulp and paper mills up in Sartell, the UPM Kimini plant, former Blandin plant in Grand Rapids, the Ainsworth facility in Bemidji, an intriguing visit at the White Earth Indian Reservation. Lee was back here with us, and we visited the Sappy and Boise Cascade Mills, Minnesota Power, and potential partners. And so we've been really diligently exploring all the opportunities. And that's based on Lee's perception that Minnesota is unique. Unique in the fact that we are the only state that has a sizable forest products industry as well as a corn ethanol industry. And it's on that infrastructure that this opportunity arises. So with that, I'm so pleased to have the opportunity to introduce to you our friend and esteemed colleague, Lee Lind.
All right. Thank you so much, Dean Eldy, for that great introduction. Welcome, Dr. Lind. We're very happy to have you here.
Thank you very much, Chairman Anderson, distinguished members of the Senate, audience members. I'm delighted to be here and to share with you, I hope, some of my excitement about this opportunity I see. So this point, I don't think, takes an awful lot of elaboration in this day and age, that energy supply and utilization pose pressing challenges. But I would like to remind us, starting broadly and then sort of zeroing in on how to get this done. And I like to look at it this way, without going through lots of numbers and statistics. Just think about, while the screen is blank here for a minute, what are the dimensions of well-being of human society? How do you tell if a society is doing well? Well, it seems to me three that would be pretty high on anybody's list would be some version of peace, sustainability, and prosperity in no particular order. And I note that if you're missing any one of those, the other two are threatened. Okay? Now, this business of peace, prosperity, and sustainability, it seems to me, has been dominated by resource access and utilization, and particularly energy. And this is actually true today, but it's always been true. And a convergence of factors makes this critical now. I don't think I need to catalog those factors. And in my view, this is a defining challenge of our time. So if we're trying to imagine a sustainable world, let's actually start with the human needs side of this. We need to feed people. We need to provide energy of various types. We need to provide materials of organic and inorganic character. We have something on the order of a half a dozen large-scale sustainable resources that could be used to meet those needs. Some might take one off this list, some might add one, but it's much closer to 6 than 10. Interestingly, the vast majority of paths from sustainable resources to meeting human needs go through two things, either plant biomass or renewable electricity. To fill this out, I lovingly call this the spaghetti diagram. Some choices are identifiable here as boxes that have multiple arrows into or out of them. I draw your attention particular to the choice of what to do with this very versatile biomass resource. Look at all the arrows coming out of that box. There also are some sole supply relationships denoted in red. And the idea here is that you only ultimately can start with one box to get to one other. You don't have multiple boxes feeding in. And I would point out that photosynthesis is the only foreseeable source of food, organic fuels, and organic materials. So an essential part of a sustainable world. Next assertion I'd like to offer you, and one could speak much longer about the challenge, but I think that's probably pretty self-evident to all of us. The next thing I'd like to offer you is this perspective that cellulosic biofuels are responsive to this challenge, although I hasten to say not by themselves, in the sense that it's a mosaic or a patchwork of solutions that are needed to navigate a transition to a sustainable world, not any one. So to just look at some background here, if you look at biofuel feedstock product and feedstock and product options, and I think I'm reminding many of us of things we already know, there's a family of products you can make from starch-rich grains such as, or starch-rich feedstocks such as corn, also a family of products that can be made from oil seeds, such as soy or rapeseed, a family of products that can be made from sugar-rich crops. There used to be much more sugar beet grown in the United States than there is now. We're not going to grow too much cane anytime soon. And then there is the category of cellulosic materials. This dividing line isn't always crisp, but in general, some of these arise as byproducts of existing activities and some of them arise as crops, where at least one of the motivations is energy production. I want to be clear that when I talk today about cellulosic ethanol, I'm not just talking about using cellulosic biomass as an energy source for ethanol manufacture. I'm actually talking about taking carbon atoms into cellulosic biomass and making alcohol from them. There is another category I want to acknowledge, which is aquatic biomass, which is worthy of investigation, but not sufficiently far along to be very easy to evaluate with any definition, in my view. So, there are quite a few feedstock and product options. To put this into perspective, I'm going to look at some of the attributes of these different feedstock categories briefly. And I start here with a table of different forms of energy, first of all listed in their common units. And I don't know that it's total coincidence that we value almost all forms of energy in different units. Barrels, thousands of cubic feet, tons, kilowatt hours, bushels, etc. But it's not particularly difficult to put these on a common scale. So first for the more conventional energy carriers. And one of the things to note here is that coal is by far the least expensive source of a BTU around. And that's in fact even true if you have to capture the carbon from coal. However, capturing carbon from coal is only an option for stationary energy generation. If you're talking about generating or producing organic fuels, capturing the carbon from the exhaust pipe of mobile vehicles is not realistic. And so this business of you can't necessarily buy your way out of the carbon dilemma for transportation with coal unless you want to make hydrogen. Now, the biomass sources are interesting because you can see soy oil and corn kernels. Certainly, the lower end of these scales do overlap with, and in fact, in the high end, in the case of corn, even at $5 a bushel, that's rough. That's a mid-range oil price, something like $75 a barrel on a per gigajoule basis. But the cellulosic crops at about $50 a metric ton, and the argument doesn't change if you make that 60, on the order of $3 per gigajoule. So two take-home messages here, and this is modified from a table that came out 2 weeks ago in Nature Biotechnology. At $3 per gigajoule, the cellulosic biomass purchase price, I'm not talking about the price of products you make from this stuff, I'm talking about what it costs to buy the raw material. The cellulosic biomass purchase price is competitive with oil at about $17 a barrel on a per energy basis. That is, $17 a barrel oil is also about $3 a gigajoule. And cellulosic biomass is, in many scenarios, the cheapest and certainly one of the cheapest sources of energy in a carbon-constrained world. Well, if we're going to make fuel from plants, another thing we need to look at is the land productivity of various biofuel options. So this is gigajoules of fuel per hectare, but just think of it as fuel per unit area. You know, we can make very little fuel per unit area growing temperate oil seeds, be they canola, soy, what have you. Corn does considerably better, on the order of 5 or 6 times the fuel output per acre as biodiesel. But cellulosic biomass, especially in the long term as we get good at producing this stuff, has potential to be much, much higher. So this is a rather busy table, but it helps to underscore the point that different plant feedstocks are responsive to different objectives. And I would comment parenthetically that sometimes it's a little bit mystifying to look at where we are in biofuels and say, well, if we were making decisions based on, let's say, sustainability and energy security, how would we get where we are? One of the big answers, frankly, is that sustainability and security until relatively recently, in my opinion, have not been particularly dominant drivers of biofuels policy, although there are signs that that's changing. So without going through all of these cells, the cellulosic feedstocks, especially as you look towards the future, score very well, green being positive. These other categories, starch-rich, sugar-rich, and oilseed, in summary, score less well at meeting a diversity of objectives. Consistent with this, cellulosic biofuels are the focus of all studies that foresee what I would call a very large-scale, widespread fuel production from plant material. And when I mean very large-scale, I simply mean big enough to really meaningfully impact these mega challenges of sustainability and security. And the reasons are, relatively simply stated. environmentally benign and in some instances beneficial production, very low purchase cost, as we've talked about, and large potential scale of production due to both broad site range as well as large amounts of fuel per unit land, as we've talked about. So a little bit about environmental and resource considerations. I'm actually going to be talking about this particular subject for an hour later this afternoon. I'll give you a much briefer, more brief version now. But replacing row crops with cellulosic perennials is regarded favorably not only by people whose main historical involvement is in biofuel production, which is my case, although I got into this field for environmental reasons and, frankly, societal service-oriented reasons, without a great deal of reward over some years, as Bob mentioned. In any case, so for example, much less much less erosion, much less pollution of surface waters and groundwaters, and less herbicide and pesticide use compared to row crops, enhanced wildlife habitat and diversity, water use efficiency several times higher than corn grain with the consequent broader site range, strong potential for recycling mineral nutrients from the processing facility to the field, decidedly positive ratios of energy out to fossil energy in, on the order of 6-to-1 for current designs and expected to be 10-to-1 as the technology matures. To put that in perspective, in the case of crude oil, if you look at the energy input to pump it out of the ground, move it around the world, and refine it as in relation to the energy actually delivered, it's about 8-to-1. So these are very, very efficient processes, especially as they're foreseen. We could talk about this a lot longer, but I will simply assert for now that achievable outcomes with diligence and foreseeable innovation include fuel production on a very large scale without negatively impacting food supply and near zero or negative greenhouse gas emissions. Again, I'll be, for those of you who might be interested, I will be talking about that at 3:30 at the University of Minnesota. So, just to make sure we understand what cellulosic biomass is, it comes in a variety of forms, but you see on the upper left, wood chips. On the upper right, a lass named Emily Hansen on her father's farm in front of a year's growth of miscanthus, and Emily Hansen's 5'4". Emily Heaton, excuse me. A picture from David Tillman of the University of Minnesota showing prairie grass. And then finally, in the lower right-hand side, paper sludge in the form that it goes to a landfill. If you pretty much think of sort of moist paper towels, you know, kind of wadded up with the water squeezed out of them, you've got a pretty good picture of what paper sludge looks like. So the next thing I'd like to do, having spoken about, in very general terms, the need and that cellulosic biofuels, in my opinion, are responsive to these energy-related challenges, I'd like to, in essence, talk about why we're not doing this now. And let's start off with just a one-slide introduction to cellulosic biofuels production technology at what I call here a greenfield plant. In other words, you start with no pre-existing infrastructure, you put a plant out in the middle of some open space, and you start business. Well, if you're going to do that, you need to think about where the raw material or feedstock is going to come from, who's going to produce it, what you're going to have to pay for it, how it's going to be stored for year-round delivery, how it's going to be transported. All doable, but nevertheless, an infrastructure that depending on the cellulosic feedstock and the location, may or may not exist already. You then, when you get within the processing facility, you have to do something called pretreatment, which basically means making the cellulosic biomass accessible to microorganisms and their enzymes. You then do the biological processing, which includes not only fermentation, but also cellulose hydrolysis, converting this insoluble stuff into soluble sugars, which are then fermented. You then have to distill the product into ethanol. You have to do wastewater treatment, and at many modern ethanol mills, a significant fraction of water is recycled. And finally, you have to generate steam and do energy recovery from process residues. So this is what a cellulosic biofuels greenfield plant would look like, and it would have 6 boxes, which we'll discuss. Well, in order to, even for an nth plant, that is a plant that you're replicating, and you've already gotten by the first of a kind obstacle, even for an nth plant, These plants have to be at least 20 million gallons to have a positive return on investment. The capital cost is at least today $5 per annual gallon, so you are talking about at least a $100 million investment to build a greenfield cellulosic ethanol plant that is a reasonable gives a reasonable investment return. Furthermore, it will take you 2 to 3 years to build that plant, which is hard on discounted cash flow because you're putting your money in up front and then you're waiting a period of time before earnings. Probably the most important point on this is the idea that when you've got multiple relatively new, not technologically mature steps, that risk is compounded in a cellulosic, in a first-of-a-kind cellulosic biofuels facility. It's also the case that not all of the steps are new. That's good news from the point of view of minimizing risk. It's bad news from the point of view that if you have to pay capital cost, if you have to pay capital cost for technology steps that are not new, you're paying high-risk money on low-risk technology, and that's not a good trade. So you can help see this here. So feedstock, production, storage, and transport, depending on the system, may well have medium technical risk. Pretreatment and biological conversion, high technical risk. The next three steps, low technical risk. And again, so you don't want to be paying expensive capital on steps with low technical risk, but if you compound all of the risks from the higher risk steps, it makes it harder to know you will succeed. So the best case for a first cellulosic ethanol plant, the best case bottom line, is very high cost, long lead time, substantial risk. These would be investments that would be attractive to replicate but are not attractive to make for the first time. Everyone's rushing to be second. The need is for lower cost, shorter time to revenues, disaggregated risk, and in short, manageable first steps to get this done. Now, the next assertion, and I believe the last of these, thank you for your patience, is that a cellulosic biofuel industries can be launched here, that is in Minnesota, I don't run around giving this particular talk to every state, can be launched here and now. Here is an overview of paper making. So you start off with cellulosic biomass, feedstock production, you pulp it, then you make paper, you do wastewater treatment, you do steam generation and energy recovery, you produce a solid sludge, so-called paper sludge, which is either land-applied or land-filled, typically. Sometimes people put it in boilers, but not with very much enthusiasm. It's a waste disposal, not an energy recovery approach. And I'd like to note a few things. Number one, I won't go back and forth between them, but there's a fair amount of similarity between the steps in paper making and cellulosic ethanol production. Indeed, some common steps, like wastewater treatment and steam generation. Number two, there are two ways you could potentially produce ethanol at a paper mill without decreasing paper yields. One, take this waste, this solid paper sludge that I showed you a picture of, currently a waste product, and make it into ethanol. And it so happens, my lab has tested around 40 sludges from North America, various paper mills, and we find that a substantial fraction of them are fortuitously pretreated. Recall that pretreatment means that microorganisms and their enzymes can get at the cellulose. It happens that in the course of paper making, that's done for us. Okay? The second stream is further up. One can, prior to pulping, extract hemicellulose, which is a kind of carbohydrate, and which is fermentable and can be converted to ethanol. As you might expect, taking a stream out above the main site of value creation in paper making rather than at the end of that stream of value, its integration is more complicated for this so-called value prior to pulping or hemicellulose extraction, but it's a significant flow and ultimately an attractive opportunity, although not as near term. So I thank you for staying with me. I'm now going to show you the most important slide. So here to begin with is, oh, and arrived just in time, too. Here to begin with is the six steps, or are the six steps I showed you previously for greenfield cellulosic ethanol production. But now let's revisit these steps, assuming that we were doing this at a pulp and paper mill. So we've got a point source of raw material, which is there year-round. And so we don't have to worry about lining up feedstock supply, storage, and transport. Pretreatment is not required for either paper sludge conversion or hemicellulose extract conversion. That removes a major cost, risk, and et cetera. If we're doing this in Minnesota, which, as Bob commented, is the only state in the country that has both a well-developed forest products and pulp and paper industry as well as corn ethanol industry, what I think you would logically do, especially for the first plant, rather than going to complete product recovery to the point you can blend the stuff with gasoline, you would do the easy part of distillation, which is to purify the ethanol up to about 70%, most of the water's gone, put it in a truck and drive it downstate somewhere to a corn ethanol plant and have them finish it off, deal with the blenders and the marketing and all that stuff that they know how to do. Wastewater treatment and steam generation are present infrastructure at paper mills. So by taking the greenfield model but then considering this and modifying it for a paper mill, we find that what was six steps is now one and a fraction. All we're doing is biological conversion and sort of pre-distillation. We use pre-existing infrastructure for low-cost process steps, distillation, wastewater treatment, and steam generation. We avoid the cost and complexity and risk of pretreatment. These plants, we project, will cost less than $10 million. They will take less than a year to build. Recall, the greenfield plants were well over $100 million and will achieve positive cash flow even at that small scale. My last slide before I turn it back over to Bob, just want to give you a sense that this is a distinctive expertise, converting paper sludge to ethanol. I'll get to hemicellulose extract conversion in a minute. This is a distinctive expertise of my research group. We've been working on this since 1992. As I mentioned, we've tested sludges from over 40 North American mills. We've had three PhD theses completed. There's actually a list of work we've done. I won't drag us through every detail. There are two very promising sites that have been identified in Minnesota. One is the Sappy Mills, and that should be in Cloquet and not Duluth, excuse me. And the other one, I'm struggling with your geography as well, Madam Chairman.
Yeah.
And the other one is the Boise Cascade Mill in International Falls. It's been verified that these two sites have the daily production of sludge, the composition of sludge, and the reactivity that satisfy criteria for commercial feasibility. They also have available steam power and wastewater treatment capacity available at incremental cost. And finally, we've had positive initial meetings with both of these mills and indeed are delighted to have a representative from the Boise Cascade Mill here with us today. As far as commercial production, construction of a cash flow positive facility could begin in the summer of 2008 and be completed in the first quarter of 2009. That is it's not a guarantee that will happen. That's an express schedule, and we have to get busy if we want that to happen, but it's certainly an intriguing and appealing possibility. Research and development that is not required for that first facility to be cash flow positive would nevertheless make replication of that initial application much more positive elsewhere. It's about a $5 billion global market to produce ethanol at a pulp and paper mill, not a small market opportunity, and close to a third of that is in the United States. As far as hemicellulose extract, this is a distinctive expertise not of my group, but actually of Professor Scherner at the University of Minnesota, work that... I don't remember all of the acronyms of the organizations Bob's involved with, but one of them at least funds Professor Scherner, I'm pretty confident. Compared to paper sludge, this is a less immediate opportunity, but no less promising ultimately. Commercial production will require lab and pilot work. I look forward to discussion and questions in whatever direction you want to lead it, but before that, pass the microphone back to Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. So I would like to summarize with this slide in terms of the scale of what this would both cost and what it would do for us as a state of Minnesota. The cost, as Lee hinted at earlier on, is on the order of a tenth of the minimum cost of a greenfield cellulosic ethanol plant. That is, it's on the order of $10 million. The way we envision it, it's a $5 million and followed by a $5 million investment. The initial $5 million is for design, development, and the technological improvements that are needed, and the second is matching funds for plant construction. We're so intrigued and impressed by the visits we've had with the mills, where there is space to essentially plug in this technology right next to the waste streams and avert the current diversion of those waste streams to lands. So this is really something that economies of time and economies of investment are really manifest by capitalizing on this. The benefits, I think, are enormous. As we say here on this slide, and we can talk more about other benefits and we welcome questions, this is a new value platform for the pulp and paper and forest products industries. Those industries, as we hear it, are crying out for such value-added strategies. Ethanol is the first step, but other value-added bio-based products and chemicals would undoubtedly, as at regular refineries, oil refineries, much more value is created by high-cost chemicals and so on. So we envision this is the platform that could enable that. This would truly be the birthplace for the cellulosic biofuels industry. Could we do that here and in this kind of a time frame that we're proposing? People would come to Minnesota to see how to do it. And I think the value of that is extremely important for the aspirations we have as a state. It provides a real living laboratory for the transitions from our current ways of making ethanol using starch from corn. And I think we would be in the heart of being able to steer and guide those transitions in a sustainable sort of way. This offers strengthening economic opportunities for parts of our state that are economically challenged. It would further position us as a leader in renewable energy, and it would respond to the regional, national, and global challenges that have been outlined in the first part of Lee's presentation. And finally, and I think this is also very important, if we can provide the test bed for this kind of innovation, I think this kind of opportunity would invite further innovations and further such initiatives and would really cement our place in this rapidly evolving, highly competitive world to create sustainable ways of transporting ourselves around this planet. So with that, I'm grateful for the attention you've been able to give to this topic, and we're eager to try to address any questions that you might have.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad we have a lot of members here to listen to this proposal because it's really an exciting opportunity for Minnesota. And I think, as you said, we're uniquely positioned to take advantage of this. So this is, you know, we've talked a lot about how to help the transition to the next generation of biofuels, and it's a very complex process with a lot of different pieces, and starting with trying to, you know, grow feedstocks. And this sort of leaps right over that issue. I mean, obviously, we're going to have to look at a whole range of solutions, but this is really exciting because it's taking a waste product that we've already got and turning it into fuel. So I think there's going to be a lot of enthusiasm here for seeing how we can help make this happen. Let's take some committee questions. I think Senator Saxhog was first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Eldier or Dr. Lind, would you discuss again what the advantage Minnesota has because it has both agriculture and forests, you know, in one location? And then you didn't discuss it up there, but that those plants that you're talking about that have both sludge and I saw a thing, black liquor, is that the advantage those two plants in Cloquet and the International Falls have over, say, Grand Rapids and Sartell? Or
Dr. Lynn?
Well, I'll take the second one first. I remember that one better. We can come back to the first one. Yeah, essentially, what we learned when we looked at many, many different, well, we learned a few things, but one of the things we learned when we looked at many, many different paper sludges is that the processes that involve chemical pulping are often very reactive and very attractive for ethanol production. The ones that involve mechanical pulping with very little actual reaction are never useful. So, for example, newsprint is a process called groundwood. Essentially, you reduce the particle size, glue it together, and those are never fortuitously pretreated, and then we're back to needing to pretreat biomass, which is part of what we're trying to avoid. In round numbers, I think somewhere between a third and a half of the mass production of paper sludge produced by the entire industry would be a good raw material for cellulosic biofuel production. It's not all of it, but it's not 10% either. And it happens, going directly to your question, that the processes that produce black liquor are the ones that are chemical pulping as opposed to mechanical pulping. So there is a correlation there. And the other question had to do with why...
why ethanol and forestry together is
a... make a powerful combination, yeah. Well, you've got infrastructure for the fuel, but most specifically, if you want to do this idea, I mean, essentially what we're trying to do is to, especially for the mature steps, build on as much existing infrastructure as possible. You've got paper mills. Not every state has paper mills. Iowa, for example, has got lots of corn ethanol plants, but they don't have many paper mills. Illinois doesn't have many paper mills. They have a few more than Iowa, but not many. So you need paper mills to do this idea. But if you're going to do that specific strategy of taking the ethanol and finishing it at a corn ethanol plant instead of locating the entire distillation at a paper mill, you also need corn ethanol. So if you look at your big forest product states, Michigan and Wisconsin amongst the lake states, New York and Pennsylvania out toward where I live, you know, none of them have appreciable corn ethanol industries.
So you said, Dr. Lind, you said that a third to a half of the sludge that's produced in, I think, in the whole industry, you said,
yes,
in the whole paper
industry? Yes, in the pulp and paper industry,
in North America or in the world?
It's not significantly different in the world. So
and how much ethanol could you produce from that amount of sludge, roughly?
On the order of 500 to 700 million gallons, and that's a small number. As you appreciate, current ethanol capacity, I haven't checked lately, but I'm sure it's more. It's 6 to 7 billion gallons. Gasoline usage is 140 billion gallons. We're talking less than a billion gallons worldwide. That's from paper sludge, actually. You can roughly triple that if you add in the hemicellulose. Mm-hmm. So that would bring you up to on the order of 1.5 billion gallons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're selling ethanol at $2.50 or so. So as I mentioned, on the order of a $5 billion opportunity, more if you layer on higher value chemicals as co-products, which would likely happen. We're not going to save the world's energy problems converting waste paper sludge. But what we desperately need in this industry is a place to start. There's this cliff that at the bottom is littered with skeletons and broken poles where people came along with a 10-foot pole trying to vault a 100-foot cliff, and predictable things happen. So what we need to do is to reduce this into steps that are doable and rewarding commercially. And I think this is the way to get going. And once this was operating, I think there'd be all sorts of exciting spin-offs, because essentially the biological conversion is really the highest risk element. You take that and you move it from the high-risk category to the low-risk category, and you ask, okay, now what can I do? So it gets you going.
So do you think, I mean, as you said, this is only going to provide us a piece of the biofuels that we need to try to convert our transportation
yes.
system to renewable energy, but do you think the technology that you're talking about has the potential to be applied to other materials?
Without a doubt. I mean, with some translation, mind you, there are some feedstock-specific issues, but the fundamental unit operation of biologically converting solid cellulose with enzymes, we add amylase to starch, but that's a different enzyme and a different raw material. So yes, there's no doubt in my mind at all that if this plant were operating, that experience would enable subsequent applications for other feedstocks. I think any expert in cellulosic biofuels, that's not a contentious position. That's a consensus view.
Dr. Eldy.
And Senator Anderson, if I might, I think another reason to come back to why Minnesota is, as we've talked about in the past, Minnesota is the intersection of the three great biomes that define the North American continent. And as such, we have feedstock that vary in each of those, potential feedstock that can be experimental and is sustainably grown in each of those areas. So we are really a great test bed for diversifying the feedstock. So get it going, get it operating correctly and efficiently with one feedstock that's low-hanging fruit, and then we're the great test bed for experimenting with prairie sorts of species, with the boreal forest products from the north and the hardwood kind of forest brushlands from the south. I think that's a further reinforcement for why Minnesota.
And I'm wondering, this sludge, does it have chemical components in it that make it kind of a hazardous thing to dispose of? This has an additional benefit.
Sludge is actually rather well washed. It's rather dilute as it comes to the primary clarifier within the paper mill. It's roughly 50 to 60% organic matter and 40% minerals. The main minerals are clay and calcium carbonate, which is essentially chalk, and it's there as filler because it's cheaper to buy minerals than to make pulp. There is some titanium dioxide in it, which is quite valuable. Titanium dioxide is used in things like abrasives and sandpaper and stuff like that. One of the interesting things, and I don't think this would happen the day the plant would open. However, one of the interesting opportunities is the prospects for accessing the minerals in the paper sludge are very grim if you've got to go through this oatmeal-like cellulose. When the cellulose is gone, we've actually made hand sheets from the mineral residue, that is, paper samples, and they do very well in terms of burst strength and brightness. So there's at least a prospect for not only taking the carbohydrate to ethanol, but taking the other component of this sludge and putting it back into the paper, which would be a nice case of loop closing.
Senator Chaudhry, did you have a question?
Thanks, Madam Chair. And you had your step process that you had shown. Does that then presume that there will be presume the current demand for paper, and what happens if the demand for paper goes down?
Well, of course, the thing that with this, the tide that a particular plant would float on wouldn't be the overall national demand, but the output of that particular plant. You see what I'm saying? In other words, if we locate at the Boise Cascade plant and don't have provisions to truck paper sludge several hundred miles from somewhere else, which probably wouldn't want to do, I don't think. So, you know, if the Boise Cascade plant makes less sludge, we're going to make less ethanol. If it makes more sludge, we could talk about expanding. So we're very tied to the specific mill in this case. And, you know, one of the things that will need to be discussed is,
what the mill's plans are and how
stable the output is. So that is a consideration the very virtue of this strategy is to not be buying all these components yourself, but be able to build off existing infrastructure. Therefore, you're very dependent on the integration relationship with the mill. And if the mill sludge production had, your ethanol production would have.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Chaudhry,
what we've sort of experienced with the value add of the corn ethanol, and what I'm wondering about, the same thing will happen with the cellulosic, particularly the trees, the tree stock, is that when you start that value add, that becomes then takes over as the focus. And whether this plant engages in that or some other plant, what we've seen is that there is a great rush to produce that, and we've seen all sorts of ramifications as a result, whether it be on prices, whether it be on the environment, or other agricultural industries. So, and particularly, and I certainly appreciate any comments that Dr. Eldy has as well, particularly when we're seeing the boreal forests, beginning of the boreal forest starting to become hardwood forests.
Yeah, sure.
What will be the impact on this type of cellulose once we start adding that value, particularly given the corn experience?
In
Dr. Lind.
In general, the matter of feedstock supply and its implications very multifaceted. It's something I happen to have thought and written a lot about and have written a lot about. I would say, in summary, that there are no unsolvable problems, and indeed there are some wonderful opportunities associated with increased production of perennial cellulose biomass. I say wonderful opportunities, for example, the capacity to decisively remove carbon from the atmosphere, not just break even on fuel production, due to carbon storage in the soil, which means that in a world that was motivated, for example, by value of carbon removal, you could co-motivate land reclamation, fertility enhancement, and greenhouse gas emission abatement, as well as renewable fuels. So there are some truly wonderful synergistic scenarios. At the same time, these benefits will not happen without diligence. And when you put a new demand on a natural system, it is possible to screw it up. Okay? It is possible to do it irresponsibly. And so this cellulosic feedstocks have many advantages compared to their row crop counterparts, but none of those are an insurance policy. So we have to be very diligent about, and I think frankly, to some extent, we collectively have a second chance to launch this new chapter of the industry with very close attention to a suite of objectives, which includes sustainability, rural economic development, value realization by growers, et cetera. So we need to pay close attention to these issues, and if we do pay close attention, there are many benefits and no unsolvable problems that I see.
Well, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the comment, and the concern I have is that number one, trees don't grow as fast as switchgrass. And so as a result, the next convenient thing to produce that cellulose will be our existing forests, which could be a benefit to an extent. But like you said, I think there are potential dangers with that as well. And most importantly, in this arena, policymaking arena, economic development oftentimes, most of the time, trumps sustainability. And so, hence my question: are we going to create the same rush for timber as we have for corn? And that might help it, the feedstock issue, but now you suddenly the price of wood has gone up. And you could very easily see rippling effects in the housing industry and other places. So,
your concerns are well-founded. Many of these issues I'm going to speak to at some length in the talk at 3:30. I realize people are no doubt busy and many won't be able to make it, but your concerns are well-founded, but there are many elegant strategies by which cellulosic biofuels could, or cellulosic biomass could be produced from currently managed lands, which don't happen now because there's no demand for this stuff. And so while it's true that some of the heightened demand scenarios could lead to the kinds of difficulties you describe, it's also equally true, that this could be a means of revitalizing rural America by this very, very large new value proposition. And I think it is within society's capacity to steer it so that the goods are realized and the bads are avoided.
I hope that's the case.
Senator Anderson, if I might just add. Senator Chaudhary, I think also, this committee itself mandated harvesting guidelines for Minnesota's forests several years ago. And I think a run on the forests to make ethanol is not a likely scenario in the near future. Appreciate that this process that Lee has pointed out is using what is currently a waste stream out of the primary business of a paper mill, making paper. And I think it's really worthwhile to bring attention to the American public that our waste streams, municipal waste streams, are different, but they have energy, latent energy in those streams. Many of our industrial processes have latent energy in those waste streams, that to be prudent stewards of our natural heritage, use of those waste streams to create and capture latent energy is an extremely important step forward as well. So your point is well taken, and policy and technology types can't walk off in different directions here. It's got to be a closely knit march.
Let me just ask, and then I'll call on you, Senator Han, about the economics of this. You talked about up there the $10 million to get this thing going, and then you said matching funds. Does that mean there'd be additional? I mean, how much would it cost? Really, what I want to know is how much is this ethanol going to cost to produce? compared to what these ethanol plants can produce themselves. Is this a money-making stream for the paper mill? Is there commercial profit to be made from this right off the bat?
I can try to address those very good questions. The thought at this point is that to get this going would take some things that would happen, some activities that would happen before the plant was built. It so happens that the safe, in my view, estimate of $10 million to build the plant is the same as the total of the sum of the amount that would need to happen before the plant. It's not all before. The amount that would happen that was not for plant construction, plus the half that it seemed that we're suggesting here the state might provide, that would be matched dollar for dollar by an industrial partner to actually build the thing. Okay? So the first plant would not be a rewarding return on investment. Somebody who was looking to make 20% on their money or something would find somewhere else to put it. It would achieve positive cash flow. It is literally, that is, it would more than cover its operating expenses. It is literally at the scale of a pilot plant for most cellulosic biofuels, but it's this nifty thing, which is a pilot plant you can't afford to shut down. And to me, there's this continental divide in technology demonstration. When you have something that costs can't sell into the market and cover its costs, it's just waiting till you run out of money to operate it. This would sell into commercial ethanol markets at the market price. It wouldn't sell at a different price, and it would cover its costs. And one of the values you would get for these two investments in addition to the first plant is moving the technology along such that by the time the first plant was operating, the replication of that technology would be a much more attractive investment due to the learnings from the operation of the plant and other learnings as well.
And how many gallons could you make from one paper mill?
About 1.5 million gallons a year, which is very small, but that's part of the virtue. To be able to get into cellulosic ethanol production at that small scale with this small price tag is all about making this a manageable bite-sized step.
Senator Anderson, if I might add, in addition, if the hemicellulose extraction method could be scaled up, the output of that plant could probably triple.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and I appreciate that your message, Dr. Eldy, is this would just be the catalyst that could start off a whole ripple effect of research, development, and interest in where do we go from here. Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and doctors. And actually, my question is very similar to what Senator Anderson was asking about, which is the economics of this thing. And the description you have here is very positive and seems to be, as you described it, there were lots of upside potentials and very few, if any, insurmountable problems with it, which makes me wonder why we can't find private investment to do this.
Well, as I mentioned, the first plant's not a very attractive investment.
Well, Madam Chairman, Dr. Lind, I appreciate that, but that's not unusual in many innovative technologies that if people believe in these things and believe they have long-term capitalization opportunities, that there is some risk that's assumed up front, and if the benefit is perceived over time to have a pretty significant payoff, then that's why people invest their funds in it. The concern I have is that as a legislative body, we may not be in the best position to assess that risk. We have not heard, for example, in detail today what the risks are. You talk about there's a lot of things that could potentially happen, but I'm sure there are substantial risks that could make this an absolute failure. But we should be, if we're going to be an investment banking house, we should know those things, and we should be able to assess what is the chances of it being successful and what's the chances of it not being successful and what the risk to the state might be. And I think Senator Chaudhry's questions about the experience we've had with the corn ethanol industry, I think, are cautionary. We did some things at statewide policy level to create a market, to create a demand for a product, to provide subsidization to lower the cost of that to the marketplace. And we have built an industry primarily on public money that is very questionable today whether that is sustainable absent that public money. In addition to all that, we've created demands in the marketplace that may not be an accurate reflection of where the market wants to be in terms of uses for products. So my question is, you're saying here that there's about a $10 million apparently investment here, which doesn't seem to be substantial. The benefits you described to the paper, pulp, forest products, agriculture industry would seem to me that's a fairly low investment to make given the kinds of rewards. Why wouldn't they just say, let's put in $10 million, let's get this thing going, and if we need to, I think as a legislature we could provide some kind of accelerated depreciation or maybe some favorable tax benefits to encourage investment and say, okay, make the investment. If it doesn't pan out after 10 years or 5 years, maybe there's some way you can write that off and not, you know, be not necessarily held harmless, but at least not go into economic disaster over that. Why wouldn't we do that rather than say, let's have taxpayers fund this thing and build it and see what happens?
Well, speaking of risk, you'd be taking a risk. It wouldn't happen. I am a co-founder and a member of the board of directors of a startup company in the cellulosic ethanol space. As I say to my wife, I have input on almost all levels and final decision-making authority on none, and so I can speak fairly freely. I think my company is in a position to evaluate the proposition you describe in the absence of state funds, and I frankly doubt we would invest in it in this time frame, absent some form of governmental assistance. As far as, and you know, it's impossible to argue with your idea that, or your statement that if the state is going to be a financier, then they need to know more than has been told to you thus far. It would seem to me, as the out-of-stater here, that that might be a function that the cellulosic Minnesota Cellulosic Biofuels Working Group might be charged with, but that's up to you. Part of the spirit, as we've thought about what would make this make sense and try to make the price tag as low as we can, is that certainly the state should not be asked to fund building a commercial facility that someone else isn't also taking, someone knowledgeable in a position and in a position to evaluate the risks isn't taking the risk with you. And that was the reason for the matching funds on the building of the actual commercial facility. But I would think that, well, maybe you want to comment, Bob, on how all of this might roll forward from here.
Dean Eldy.
Senator Anderson, Senator Hahn.
I mean to be usurping your role, I'm sorry.
Good conversation.
Perhaps prior to addressing that, I'd just like to add, I think that in this space, we have intense competition from other states. So we can establish principles by which we will operate. But as a case in point, the company with which Lee is associated has not only been courted but supported with significant funds from the state of New York, from the state of Michigan, the state of Tennessee, and I probably don't know of what else is going on. So the norm in launching this new industry has been for states to bid for facilities to occur in their state. And I think we have an opportunity, in spite of the investments and gestures, substantive investment gestures by those states, we still have an opportunity that's unique and can get it going first because we're not starting with a greenfield, we're starting with a pulp and paper mill. And so I think we still have a really good chance in that race. But I understand your question, and I think this state would absolutely be your demand for risk assessment is exactly on track, and we would be in a position to provide that if asked to bring a more formal proposal forward.
And I appreciate this discussion. It's very helpful. And Senator Hahn, you're absolutely right. I agree as well that, well, first I want to clarify that we don't have a bill in front of us, and there is not a formal request for any state financial participation in this project. But I think some of us think that might be something worth looking at because it's a really exciting opportunity that could potentially have a tremendous amount of spinoff benefit, and it's, you know, the times when we want to get the state involved is not in every private business venture, but in those where we can, you know, try to further the policies that we have already adopted as a state that we support, which is to move to help the transition to cellulosic ethanol as quickly as possible, to try to meet carbon reduction goals and try to, you know, enhance rural economic development at the same time. And if we can try to move in that direction in a way that helps something happen that might not happen otherwise, it's definitely worth looking at. You know, a number of us are looking at kind of the green manufacturing ideas, trying to figure out how all the great strong policies that we passed as a state in the last couple of years that put us in the leading position in terms of renewable energy policy, carbon reduction policy, biofuels policy. We have great policies, but we're not necessarily seeing the economic benefit that should be bringing to our state. We want all the jobs. We want the industries to come here. We want the benefit here in our state. And so sometimes that may take some look at our economic development policies and seeing if we can put any dollars on the table, as scarce as those dollars might be right now. So I'm interested in having that discussion. And Dr. Eldy, could you give us some more detailed analysis of this with your working group? You know, what are the risks, the cost, yes, benefit analysis, the risks and benefits to the state, to any kind of state participation? What could that look like, and what would it need to look like? Is that something that you could provide for us?
Senator Anderson, members of the committee, yes, I would be very eager to do that. And I would also like to be certain that questions that you have would be addressed in that analysis and in that proposal.
And another piece of that would be to ask if the paper mill industries, and I know they're going through their own challenges right now, and the ethanol industry have some interest in participating in this as well. I mean, we haven't invited them to come and testify today, but that would be a good question as well. Is there some interest in investment or in partnering with this? I know you've already had a lot of those discussions, but it would be helpful to get a little more detail about that as well. Great. Are there other questions from the committee? All right. Well, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention and for coming to visit us, and Dr. Eldy for sharing your sense of enthusiasm about the opportunities that we have here with this great work that Dr. Lind is doing. And so with that, thank you again. And I know I'm going to be in the Energy Committee while you're making your presentation at the U, so I can't go, and probably most of us are in the same boat. But we appreciate the invitation and look forward to getting some further response from you, Dr. Eldy, and your working group about how we could help to move this forward in Minnesota.
Senator Anderson, thank you very much. For those of you in the audience who don't have copies of the seminar announcement, it's this afternoon at 3:30. In the Cargill Building, room 105 on the St. Paul campus. You're very welcome.
Followed by a wine and cheese reception.
Yes. Join us for either or both.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Tom, do you want a chair for the
chair?
Bill? Thank you.
Do we have more copies of the PowerPoint presentation?
If you'd give us a card or jot your name down, we could send it.
Oh, sorry.
You're here for that.
That's great.
Yeah, just the cell phone.
It'd be two places.
So Bill's coming up.
John, are here. Thank you so much.
I have a card in there. I keep giving them out.
All right. Senator Anderson.
And I don't want to steal this from you here.
Conversations in the hallway. We'd appreciate it. Thank you so much. Very good to meet you.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Take care.
Our next bill, the next bill before us, Senate File 2492. Senator Anderson, and I'll just turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is the LCCMR appropriation recommendation to the legislature for 2008. And as you'll recall, we've switched to a yearly process with the LCCMR. And as we mentioned in previous committee hearings, the five Senate members of the LCCMR all serve on this committee. So we're very well represented here and very familiar with what's in this proposal, which is a recommendation to the legislature, which has to be formally adopted through this bill process. And so the proposal for this year is for the one year appropriation would be for $22.866 million from trust fund earnings. And then there's a couple of very minor pieces that are in addition to that, but I'll get to that as I go through the bill. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment as an author's amendment just to get the bill in the right shape. And do members have that?
Everybody have the A1? It's in the packet.
And it's just a technical amendment that clarifies a couple of words on a work, what do you call it?
Extension.
An extension of an appropriation for one of the previous proposals for the Paul Bunyan Trail connection. That was approved by the commission.
Senator Anderson offers the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Not all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Great. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair. What I'll do is just go through the bill and just briefly explain the proposed allocations of the money. And then we have the staff here with us from the LCCMR, the director, John Valleen, and Susan Thornton. And they can answer any detailed questions that you have, because my memory might be a little fuzzy from all the hours of hearings we had in the summer of fall and fall. So let me go through that, and then we can have some discussion. As I mentioned, the total appropriation from the trust fund that we had available to us was $22.866 million. You'll see on the first page the $86,000 in the first column, and that's an additional amount in this bill that comes from the Great Lakes Protection account. And that was available to us as well, and we had to appropriate, or we had to recommend that allocation for a Great Lakes protection related purpose. So that you'll see in the bill as well. Turning to page two, let me go through the categories first, just to give you a sense of what the big picture is, and then I'll go through the details. I think members have this handout with a yellow sheet in front, and this. It's a packet of information that kind of lays out the big picture of where the money, what the proposals are, and where the money is allocated. Do you have those? Uh-oh. Well, you guys are supposed to have them. So they must be in our office. Sorry about that. Okay, I'll explain it, and you'll get them in a minute. We looked at four major categories under which we would allocate dollars: land and habitat, water resources and protecting water resources, natural resource information, and environmental education. And if you break down the dollars that we allocated, they fit into those categories, and with a little more specificity, about $12 million we recommended for land acquisition projects, and that will be for protecting forests, wetlands, and other habitat. And that would be for an outcome of approximately 3,400 acres that would be protected. That's not now under protection, any kind of protection status. So it would be either under an easement or under fee title purchase. The second major outcome category would be in land restoration. And this is about $2.5 million. And that includes activities such as soil preparation, native vegetation installation, and exotic and invasive species removal. And these restoration activities will occur on an estimated 12,900 acres. So that's a really broad impact around the state. And that's where a lot of the water resource protection occurs as well, under both of those, to try to protect, maintain, and enhance shorelines along water bodies in Minnesota. Natural resource planning, inventory, and analysis. The LCCMR feels really strongly that we need to have foundation data available to us about our natural resources, starting from groundwater and working up to the top of the land and in all the different categories that would entail. And so, you know, we're trying to continue and complete the process of the county biological surveys, the soil surveys, the other scientific work that's being done to collect data so that we have a full inventory of natural resource data available to use as we make our policy decisions. That also includes water inventory, so we'll get to that in some of the proposals. Natural resource research is about $2 million in real academic research that'll get us new information about ideas to help inform our policies. And finally, environmental education and outreach, and that's about $1.2 million. So now you have that. That's what I was just looking at is the first long white sheet in that packet, which is the second page that I just went through that briefly. So now I'm just going to go through the bill briefly and highlight the projects. Page 2 of the bill, the Metro Conservation Corridors, which is a project we funded repeatedly over a number of periods of time. $3.15 million is the recommendation for that. And then the partner to that, or the counterpart to that, is the Habitat Conservation Partnership, which is the Outstate or Greater Minnesota Conservation Corridors project. And that we're recommending the same amount of $3.15 million. At the top of page 4, the Vermilion River Corridor Acquisition Project. And this is, I don't think it's the same land, Senator Parisot, but it's the same general vicinity. It's Vermilion River, as we talked about in the bonding bill, to protect some of that land in Dakota County near the trout stream. Let's see, page 6, preserving the Avon Hills landscape, $337,000 for a grant to St. John's Arboretum and St. John's University for some land protection and outreach activities. At the bottom of that page, the Minnesota River Valley Green Corridor Land Protection. And I remember this project was, we saw maps that looked at trying to make sure that we have buffers all along the Minnesota River, in addition to what a lot of the good work that's been done over the last few years, but to make sure that those connections are complete so that we can continue the work of restoring water quality in the Minnesota River, and also at the same time, you know, create parks and trails connections so that they're really accessible for recreation purposes. Page 7, scientific and natural areas acquisition, $1 million of additional dollars. State land, on line 7.25, state land acquisition consolidation. We're recommending $500,000, and that's to address the issue of fragmented forests, which we've heard a lot about in this committee. Page 8, state park and trail land acquisition. We put $1.5 million into that. The Metropolitan Parks land acquisition, the same amount, $1.5 million, and those require on-state match of at least 40%. Page 9, the local initiative grants. For regional parks and natural areas, we recommend $1 million to help acquire the land in Wright County that this committee also looked at in our bonding recommendations. And then at the bottom of page 9, the Conservation Partners, the Environmental Partnerships Matching Grant Program, it's a small appropriation, $150,000, but that's for small grants to communities for community-based work that involves hundreds of volunteers around the state to try to work on local natural resource improvement projects. A lot of us have probably seen those in our own districts. Page 10, the county trail system design, $175,000 to do analysis and put together a comprehensive plan for trails development in Lyon, Brown, Redwood, and Renville counties, working with the University of Minnesota. Accelerated prairie management survey acquisition and evaluation. We're recommending $1.25 million to assess our native prairies and accelerate protection efforts. And prairie system ecosystem restoration at the bottom of page 10 is a small grant to Martin County Soil and Water Conservation District for them to work on specific native plant collection and propagation so we can start to create that bigger database of native plants for our prairie plant restoration and our hopefully biofuels production in the future. Page 11, we also have best practices for native prairie management in parks. Then starting on 11.19 are some of the university and other research projects. Impacts of climate change and CO2 on the production of prairies and forests. And then at the bottom of the page, we're continuing to our support for the next phase of Dr. Tillman and Dr. Clarence Lehman's research on biofuel production and wildlife conservation using working prairies. And then on the next page, we move to the water resources, and there's a project on measuring and predicting impact on water resources of different energy scenarios in Minnesota. Another one that will look familiar to you on the bottom of page 12 is the next phase of research in trying to control invasive common carp species. Dr. Peter Sorensen is, you know, internationally known for his work in that area, and we're helping to fund some of that. Page 13, testing pesticides and degradates in public drinking water. Assessments of riparian buffers in the Whitewater River shed to improve water quality. On line 13.22, we're funding some innovative zoning ideas in Cass County to try to protect shoreland, working with local landowners. Page 14, Native Shoreland Buffer Incentives Program, again, to try to use some voluntary incentives to help encourage protection of shoreland. Southeast Minnesota Stream Restoration Projects with Trout Unlimited. At the bottom of page 14, the South Central Minnesota Groundwater Monitoring and County Geologic Atlases, and this is an effort to continue the work at testing what's in the groundwater and what the aquifers look like. And we've realized that we haven't come very far along in that process, and we need a lot more information in the southern third of the state in particular. So this is a step in that direction. On page 15, Lake Superior Research, that's the $86,000 I mentioned from the Great Lakes Protection Account for research on Lake Superior waters, which are facing a lot of challenges. Then on the bottom of page 15, we start with natural resource information projects that we funded, updating the National Wetlands Inventory, working with, I think that's one with ducks. Oh, that's with DNR. The next one is soil surveys, to continue the soil surveys. And then a project to look at precipitation intensities and how that will be affected by climate change. Minnesota Breeding Bird Atlas, which is always a popular project, and we make a point of making sure that the results of these projects are widely available for free to the public and will be disseminated and available on the website. The Restorable Wetlands Inventory, this is the one that's working with Ducks Unlimited, to look at what wetlands are out there that have the potential to be restored. Wildlife disease data surveillance and analysis, and this is a project with the Raptor Center. This is on the bottom of page 17, to look at issues in wildlife that are a broad concern to wildlife management and protection. Top of page 18, a grant to Bowser. Is that the same?
Starts at the bottom.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it starts on the bottom of page 17. Conservation easement stewardship, oversight, and maintenance. We had grants both to Bowser and to the DNR to improve their record-keeping, oversight, and enforcement of maintenance of records and enforcement of easements, conservation easements. That's been a big topic of discussion. Bottom of page 18, we start the environmental education projects. We funded a portion of the request for the Minnesota Waters documentary, which is the next big project by the people who brought you A History of the Land, which Senator Chaudhry showed in his committee. We have an innovative project on page 19 for grants to Minnesota schools, colleges, universities, to help those school communities figure out how to reduce their carbon footprints. And then finally, the emerging issues account has an allocation of $155,000. The rest of the language on the next few pages is pretty much boilerplate language that we use every year, I believe, getting back all the way to the bottom of page 23, which is where the amendment went to, and that relates to, as I mentioned, a Paul Bunyan Trail project that needed a slight extension on their time, and the LCCMR did approve that change to their work program at one of our last meetings. So that's incorporated in here. And finally, the last page of the bill is some policy language that just does two basic things. One is to make it clear that the commission's recommendations are advisory to the legislature. And then secondly, that our current law that says that any royalties or copyrights or patents, you know, that the benefits of that, the profits would have to accrue back to the LCMR and to the state, but also the sale of any products that come about by because of a grant that we give, the benefits have to come back to the state and the LCMR, LCCMR. Did I miss anything? Is there? Okay. That's kind of my summary of what's in the bill, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Senator Anderson, Ms. Thornton, or Mr. Valeen?
And, anything you wanted to say? Mr. Chair, let me just point out that, as I mentioned again, this is a one-year process, and part of what the reforms in the LCCMR have been have really focused on trying to make the process more responsive, more flexible, and more timely. And so one of the things we've made a commitment to as a group of commissioners, both citizen and legislative members, is to try to get these bills passed as quickly as possible and to kind of separate them out from the normal budgeting process. They used to always be part of the budget bills, and we've agreed to try to pass them separately and as quickly as possible, which will be really beneficial to all of our partners out there who are working in the field on these projects, so they know what's coming and they know what to expect. Even though the money won't go out, at least if we can pass it into law quickly, that will really help in the work that we're trying to support here. And so that's why we scheduled this early, and we would go next to Senator Cohen's full finance committee and onto the floor. For some reason, it didn't go to Senator Chaudhry's committee. I don't know why. I think last year they sent it there first, so they just sent it here first. I don't know. That was somebody's decision who funnels the bills out. I also wanted to mention Jeffrey Broberg is one of the citizen members who was here. We always invite them to attend, but he had to leave. So just wanted to acknowledge. He's been a great partner. So if there's no further discussion, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2492 as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the full finance committee.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 2492 as amended be approved and sent on to the finance committee. Is there any discussion on that motion? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? On to the finance committee. Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't have a meeting scheduled for Thursday this week, which is kind of nice. We put in plenty of meeting time in the last month, so I don't think you members will argue too much about that. So just wanted to announce that if you want to adjourn the meeting.
All right. With that, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.
So there's the meeting, huh?
Thank you. Nice job. Nice meeting.
Well, that was Thursday. And follow the next, you know,